Ring the bell. We've done it again. Golden Oak Lending has lowered rates to 4.875 fixed. Lower your monthly payment, get cash out, pay off credit cards, and best of all, make no mortgage payments for 2 months. Lock in this incredible 4.875 rate and get your cash in as little as 14 days. Visit goldenoaklending.com today.
Golden Oak Lending, cured my blues.
5.81 APR, FHA, 15-year, 20% equity qualified credit. Additional terms apply. NMLS 114937.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. ExpressPros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Gotta ask Baldinger if this is his speed right now.
Brian Baldinger joins us right now. NFL Network. He's on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Brian, you a big Bryan Adams fan?
Massive. I love Bryan Adams. I saw him one time in concert in Buenos Aires, and he put on an unbelievable show.
What?
Yeah. I was with a buddy of mine, and we're walking by this concert hall, and we heard this music. And my friend was like, he was like a backstage medical guy for a lot of bands.
Of course.
And he happened to know the producer of the show. And he got us some backstage passes, and we went to see Bryan Adams in Buenos Aires. It was phenomenal. It was a great show.
That Bryan, is amazing.
Is Bryan Adams, the backstage reputation, is it true?
Well, I can't speak to that. I mean, that was I know that the beers flowed freely that night.
Yes.
And that was a good thing to enjoy the show. Buenos Aires has a lot of nice sights to see, and they were on display that night.
Brian Baldinger, Odyssey NFL Insider, the host of the Best Football Show podcast. Make sure to check it out. It's the Best Football Show. It's on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. So you were on the station a few weeks ago, and you mentioned that Joe Flacco kind of showed what the Browns felt about the quarterback class. Then the Browns proceeded to go out and take two quarterbacks. Your thoughts about the Browns' plan, and if you know what the Browns' plan is at quarterback, could you help us out? Because we're all taking stabs here.
Well, I don't know what the plan is. I don't know why you would, you know, draft a quarterback with the 94th pick and then draft another one with the last name Sanders 50 picks later. I don't know why anybody would do that. So I don't know what the plan is. Dylan Gabriel is an accomplished quarterback. I think I saw him at the Senior Bowl. He looked too small to me to be able to really be a factor at that position. I mean, there is some requirements height-wise, I think, to really be efficient. But, I mean, he's played 65 or 66 games in college. He was a really good player. But it's hard enough to develop a rookie quarterback as it is, and then to draft two of them so close together, it's really kind of mystifying. So, I still don't understand it. I was there in 2014 when, you know, they drafted Manziel, and you go out to practice out there in Berea, and it was a zoo. And, Mike Pettinetta, I don't know if he knew what he was doing with that atmosphere and dealing with that. And I'm not comparing any of these guys to, you know, Johnny Manziel. But I just know that if you want to try and accurately figure out is it Dillon Gabriel or Shedeur Sanders, your number two or number three or whatever quarterback it is, it's a hard thing to do. It's hard to – there's only so many reps. There's only so many plays. There's only – there's just such little time to actually evaluate these guys. Kyle Shanahan said in San Francisco that he thought Brock Purdy was better than Trey Lance. It's 2 weeks into camp, and he couldn't do anything about it. I don't know how they're going to make this evaluation. I heard, you know, Kevin and Andrew talk about it, and they said, you know, we'll have a plan. But I don't know how you come up with a plan to figure out who's your best quarterback, who's your backup quarterback in this scenario right now.
Brian Baldinger with some strong comments to lead us off. I am curious, you know, where they go from here, because we got into it earlier in the show on what kind of a prospect Shedeur Sanders even was at this point. Now that we know that it seemed like nobody had a first round grade on him, and then he fell because of other stuff that didn't necessarily have to do with talent. So what does that buy him as a fifth round pick? Does the tie go to Dillon Gabriel? Does it go to Kenny Pickett? Does it go to Shador? What do they do in this scenario?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, moving that, you know, I was fired that question as soon as Shador was answered, was drafted on Saturday, and I didn't really have an answer then. I don't really have an answer now, honestly, guys. I mean, I want to be able to help you out and really kind of clear up the picture for everyone, because everyone's a little confused. I just know this, like, if Shador is going to make this team, if he's going to be a starting quarterback in this league, it has to start with his work ethic, his commitment, his love of the game, all that stuff has to come through, and then the talent has to ultimately come through. And so you're going to find out, is he really an accurate quarterback? Can he throw the ball in Cleveland weather or Cincinnati weather or, you know, Baltimore weather in December, in January, when, you know, the wind's coming off the lake and everything else you got to deal with, can you get it to you? I know Joe Flacco can still throw a football. You know, is he still the best option at age 40? Like, it's kind of hard to believe. Like, that's what you're leaning on right now, but that's what they're leaning on. But it's not easy. It's not going to be an easy way to navigate here. They've made it difficult on themselves, I think, drafting both guys. But for Shador, like, you got to maximize every single rep. I told people he should – I think there's an Embassy Suites hotel right across the street from Berea there or nearby. Like, he should check into the Embassy Suites, and he should just immerse himself in the playbook, getting to know the teammates, talking to Bill Musgrave every day, talking to Stefanski, really understanding the offense inside and out to give him the best opportunity to be – as good as possible, as quickly as possible.
Brian Baldinger joining us, Odyssey NFL Insider. I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, yeah, I'm not blaming you for this, by the way, Brian, but you were like, I'd love to help you guys out. Like, there's nothing you can do. This is a terminal situation here, because it's kind of like you're finding the nice way to tell us you're going to have to look for your quarterback in 2026 because this seems to be untenable. Is that possible?
It's possible. I mean, the statistics say that how many third-round or fifth-round quarterbacks become starters and bona fide starters. You're in a division with Lamar Jackson and Joe Burrow, you know, and we're in a division for a long time with Ben Roethlisberger. I mean, those are three of the best quarterbacks that we've seen, you know, in the last 20 years. And so, you know, Cleveland's been searching for theirs. You know, and look, I mean, Baker's still in the league, and, you know, some guys have had some success. But if you're telling me you're going to find a third-round or a fifth-round quarterback to be the leader that Joe Burrow and Lamar is, like, I'd say, you know, that there's no chance of that happening. You got to get those guys to the top of the draft. There's a reason why these guys get scrutinized so hard, so that they don't fall through the cracks. Now, it does happen. Kirk Cousins became a starter in the fourth round, and Brock Purdy is going to get paid an awful lot of money to be the last player taken in the seventh round, and we know what Tom Brady did. But, you know, the chance of those happening are not great. Now, maybe Shador is going to be the outlier, and or Dillon is. Who knows? And that'd be a great thing for all Cleveland Brown fans. But all, you know, every single statistic say that's far from happening.
Brian Baldinger with us. So eventually the Browns in the first round, when they traded out, got Mason Graham. What'd you think of them passing up on Travis Hunter, but also getting that first round pick out of Jacksonville the following year?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, you could debate the trade. The trade will, we won't know for 2 years, maybe 3 years. Mason Graham's a quality player, going to step in, start right away, at least be in the defensive tackle rotation. He's going to help them. The first round pick next year, maybe that helps them in the quarterback hunt next year if things don't go well this year. But that's always good if you stockpile an extra first round pick. You know, because maybe they didn't have a great plan for Travis Hunter. I thought being with all those guys from Jimmy Haslam to Stefanski to Andrew out there in Boulder, Colorado, a couple weeks ago, I was at that pro day. And I thought the Browns really fell in love with Travis Hunter. But, you know, maybe Jacksonville, and maybe they did. Maybe they still love him. But maybe the offer from Jacksonville is so great that they just couldn't turn it down. And so we'll see. We'll see how Jacksonville uses him. I think he's a dynamic player, and I would want him on my team. And I'd love to use him both ways from every standpoint. I think the fans are going to love the guy. I think he loves football like nobody else loves football. And I think he's super talented. So I would want him on my team. But, you know, the trade is a good trade. I think it could – trades actually do benefit both teams sometimes. So you have to wait a couple of years to see how it plays out, see what they do with that first-round pick next year, and to see the picks they got this year. You know, and we'll see how that plays out. But you have to usually wait 2 years to see how it unfolds.
So we've been doing this 13 years here at this station, and one of the things that I've tried to learn over the time is just because there's players that, yeah, I definitely don't like and I don't want the Browns to take. And there's also players that maybe just because I haven't seen them or haven't seen them as much or don't know as much about them, that doesn't make them bad players. Because I think so many times we haven't heard of some guys and all of a sudden we think that they're duds. And Carson Schwessinger fell into that second category because, yeah, I watched a handful of UCLA football games, but I can't tell you that I sat there expanding and talking about all the great things that Carson Schwessinger does. You like this pick, though, for the Browns. You think he's going to be a very good fit, Brian?
Yeah, I do like him. I mean, it's a 1 year of production now. So, you know, what happened the other 2 years? But he looks like he's just dripping with instincts. And I don't know what JOK's future is, you know, with that neck injury that he sustained. I mean, he was a dynamic player in Jim Schwartz's scheme. But this guy is, this guy gets to the football. He's big. He plays fast. I don't know how fast he actually is. But he plays very fast. He's all over the place. I mean, I think he's a really good player. To see him taken, you know, maybe at, you know, the first pick of the second round, probably had him a little higher than what a lot of people had him at. I thought there were some good linebackers, you know, Jalen Walker and Jahad Campbell. I mean, he's picked two picks behind Jahad Campbell. I didn't really have him that high. But I think he's a really good player. And I know one defensive coordinator that I'm pretty close with loved him. He went all the way out to, you know, to Southern California, met with him, loved him. I knew that this particular team was very interested in him. I don't know if they would have taken him this high in the second round. But regardless, I think he could be a day one starter for the Browns. I think Schwartzy will really like him.
I wanted to ask you about somebody who we in Northeast Ohio certainly watched a lot of, Harold Fannin Jr. An interesting pick because he's so young and hasn't had a ton of time at tight end. His running style is considered a little awkward, and yet all I saw against Texas A&M and Penn State was him running away from defenders.
Well, I mean, there's the game speed, and you know, there's you know, everybody is built a little bit different. I mean, this was a good draft for tight ends, and Harold was right there in the middle of it. I know some teams that met with him that did not like him. I mean, just flat out, we're not a fan. And but you know, he was very highly touted. And look, that offensive coordinator or that head coach at Bowling Green is now the offensive coordinator in Philadelphia. And so there was a great connection there. Philadelphia was looking at a tight end. I know they were interested in Harold. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, Njoku has been injured, missed some time. Tight end is a position of need, I think. And so he's going to get a great opportunity in an offense that Kevin Stefanski has always featured. two tight ends. So he's going to get an opportunity right away to get on the field.
The running backs at Ohio State this year have been compared basically throughout, and the Browns took one. I can't really argue big time because the one they took was really good at Ohio State. My alma mater, I like Travion Henderson a little bit more because I thought he was more versatile. What do you make for the differences in those guys, and did the Browns make the right pick?
Well, I mean, Quinshon's a bigger back. You know, he's just bigger and more powerful. And so, you know, one guy is 20 pounds heavier than the other. They're both equally as fast for the most part. I would say Travion catches the ball a little bit better, but Quinshon's got incredible balance. And maybe that was because he was a great skateboarder. I myself never will be seen on a skateboard. I don't have that kind of balance. But, you know, the guy's got tremendous balance. I've seen him, some of his workouts that he does. Like, I don't know how he stays on these, you know, these objects that he's balancing on. But they got taken at, what, 36 and 38? I mean, these guys were neck and neck, and they split reps. I thought they helped each other out, to be honest with you, because Travion was a four-year starter. Quinshon, a three-yard, I think, this year. The way they balanced the 16-game schedule that they had to win the national championship, they split reps. And so sometimes Quinshon got hot early in games, and he got the bulk of the carry. Sometimes it was Travion. I don't know exactly how they divvied it up, but I think they both helped each other out. I think Cleveland, you know, they got the first choice, and they said, you know, we're going to take the bigger back. And so they took Quinshon.
Final one from me. Starting the season, who would be your starting quarterback for the Browns?
Well, I guess, you know, just because he had a good run 2 years ago, it would be Joe Flacco. That'd be my guess right now, that Joe is going to end up being the starter. He probably won't get a ton of work and reps just because of all of his experience, and played decently at times in Indianapolis last year, and I think he was 5-1 as the starter in Cleveland before that playoff loss. So that's my guess. It's going to be Joe Flacco at age 40.
Odyssey NFL Insider, Brian Baldinger. Follow him on Twitter, @BaldyNFL.
Baldy, we've been asking it all week, so we got to go to you. You seem like such an authority on football things. What about gorilla things? What do you think about 100 men, determined men, going up against one gorilla?
What is this all about? I don't know this.
He's
too busy watching tape. So there's a big internet argument out there, and like we asked it yesterday, we were full phone lines. Everybody wanted to get in about this. That somebody said that 100 men, grown men, fit men, could beat one gorilla. Yeah. I said I believe it to be true. Do you believe 100 men? It's taken America by storm. Do you believe 100 men could beat one gorilla to the death?
I gotta believe that you just swarmed that gorilla like bees, that they could take down the gorilla. Although I have great respect for gorilla strength. I've seen some, obviously we've all seen some videos of what they're capable of doing. I'd say 100 men could do it.
See, I think the same thing. Brian, we thank you very much for the time. All the best.
Yeah. All right, guys. You bet. Anytime.
Yes, sir. Brian Baldinger, NFL Network, Odyssey, NFL Insider. You can find him with his brand new show, The Football Show, The NFL Show. It is on the free Odyssey app. You have to check it out because he's a true football guy.
Right there, you could tell who's...
Brian Baldinger knows his football.
Who's eternally online and who's actually in the lab breaking down the film. How about when he...
It's the best football show, by the way. It's called The Best Football Show.
How about
show?
Him saying right off the bat, he doesn't know what the Browns' plan is. He doesn't understand why they did what they did at quarterback.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America for America.
We're looking for insight. This man has insight. He is Robert Mays. He's back with us. He's from the Athletic Football Show, and he's on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Robert, always great to have you with us. Thank you for your time.
Hey, Robert.
God bless you for thinking I have insight into this. That's a real level of confidence that I'm not sure I've earned.
Give me two reactions. Number one, when the Browns take Dillon Gabriel at 94 in the third round, and he's, what, the fifth quarterback off the board. And then when they take Shedeur Sanders in the fifth round at 144.
Dillon Gabriel thing, I understand it. I thought they were going to take a quarterback at some point on day two, most likely, because I just didn't think they were going to take one on day one. I never believed that to be the case. I figured they would take Travis Hunter or do something like they did. You know, that trade in and of itself is not surprising based on the current state of the Browns roster. So when they took Dillon Gabriel, it was like, okay, you know, there's the guy. There's the guy that they want to bet on, and I think that he'll have a real chance to play and start this year. And if it doesn't work out, then you're in a spot where you have two first-round picks and you can make a go at it next season. When they took Shedeur, it was a little bit shocking, just because they'd already addressed the position. But if you don't have an answer at the position and you essentially get a free roll on a guy that, even if he's limited athletically or talent-wise, was probably worth taking in the first two rounds of this draft, the downside only exists in the extracurricular stuff. It's managing the questions. It's managing the room, all of that. And I think Kevin Stefanski can handle that. So this is a team that I think saw a bargain, saw a potential value, and jumped on it. Now it's just going to be about navigating that situation on a non-football level as much as a football level.
Who do you think the Browns' starting quarterback is? We're sitting here and we're just like throwing darts at a dartboard at this point.
We kind of think it's Pickett.
We think it's Pickett.
I've made this joke a lot over the last like 72 hours. That scene in The Dark Knight where he snaps the pool cue in half and he just throws it on the ground and says, "We're going to have tryouts." That's going to be training camp in Brea this year. I mean, that's my best guess. And I think that was always going to be the case. You know, when they were conceiving of how to build the room this spring, I think it was, the Kenny Pickett thing again, you're giving up nothing to get him. He's somebody where if you want to tell yourself a story about his career, you can easily do it. Matt Canada was, I think, one of the worst offense coordinators in football for a majority of Kenny Pickett's career. Then they go out and get Justin Fields. He's unhappy. He goes to Philly. He barely plays. So we've never really seen Kenny Pickett in even a reasonable situation for more than like a game or two last year with the Eagles. I don't think it's a strong bet, but I understand doing it when you didn't have to give up anything. Joe Flacco, known quantity, break in case of emergency. If he has to play, we know he can play. And then a rookie. And the best case scenario for the Browns is you have an open competition in training camp between those three guys, and the rookie wins it. Because at least with the rookie, we've never seen it before. There's theoretical upside, and if you get value in a guy that you draft after the first round, a quarterback, it's immense. It's a huge hit. Now, it's the same situation, except you throw a fifth-round pick who's not really a fifth-round pick into the equation. So I just think that they're going to start camp, start the offseason program, and they're going to be open-minded about who the best option is and just go from there.
Robert, we saw some mock drafts that had Shedeur as the number one pick overall. Not many. More that had him as the number two pick. Then you heard rumblings that he might drop into the second round. I heard only one rumble that said this guy could drop to the third round. Should he have dropped to the fifth? And why did he?
I think a lot of people have spoken about this really intelligently. And we did a live draft show on Thursday and Friday night on the Athletic Football Show that I do with Dane Brugler, who is the best in the business. And
Dane's
we were
a local
talking
guy
about
here.
It in real yeah. time.
Dane's
from when
here.
We were getting a little bit deeper into, he's a Cleveland guy. I mean, I'm sure you guys are familiar with Dane's work, but we're getting deeper into the draft and he hadn't been picked yet. And he just said that you can't go into these meetings with teams thinking you're the one that has leverage and thinking you're the one that's going to dictate how that interaction goes. And I think that's how he went into a lot of this. And so I think it's twofold. when people, Dane had him as his 34th player in the draft. And I think a lot of people had him in a similar range, you know, just outside of the first round or, you know, in the 30s in terms of prospect rankings. That's what his talent would dictate. Okay. So him falling to the second round based on talent, I don't think is the least bit surprising. When you get into the second and third round as a quarterback, now you're on the border of whether or not you're going to be drafted as a starter, right? Like Tyler Shuck is like right there. When you get further down, when you're Dylan Gabriel, the third round, you're drafted to essentially be a backup unless it's a unique case like the Browns is. So teams are doing the calculus in their minds when we get into the back half of day three and then into day back half of day two and into day three, where they're saying, do we really want to invite this into our building if he's only just going to be a backup? Is this worth the headache when he's probably not even going to be our starting quarterback? And when you have enough teams saying no to that over and over and over again, I think that's what happens. And then the last point that I think is worth mentioning, and Dane brought up again, was a lot of teams didn't even think he'd be on the board. So I'm sure there are a lot of teams that didn't even do the homework on him. So when you have all of those other factors contributing to this, plus the fact that there were a limited number of teams who even would have drafted him to begin with, I think that you can kind of chart a path to what we saw last weekend.
To me, looking at the Browns draft, everything kind of made sense until we got to Shedeur Sanders. And then that brings into play who made the call on Shedeur Sanders. Are you here? I mean, I know what they said. I know what some people are saying. I'm just curious, are you hearing anything on who made the call on Sanders, only because it just looks out of place compared to the rest of the draft?
Not really. I mean, I haven't really done a ton of digging on it. Gotcha. I think that I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to make this like a conspiracy theory thing and just say that like Jimmy Haslam's back there like working Andrew Berry like a puppet at that stage of the draft. I just don't believe that to be true. Mm-hmm. Like, I honestly think Andrew is the one who is probably wired in such a way to make a decision like this. You know, he was only in Philly for a year, but I think that it's not an accident that he winded up with that organization, just because I think Andrew thinks about the sport in a similar way to guys like Howie, when it's like, where are the arbitrage opportunities? Where are the edges we can find? Where are the value propositions that we can tap into? And at that stage of the draft, Shedeur Sanders is a value proposition. He's a distressed asset at that point. And so to see Andrew do that in that moment, I don't think is necessarily surprising. So I'm sure some people are going to want to make it more nefarious and more complicated than that. At first glance, I just am not doing that, because I actually do think it's in character with the way that Andrew Berry thinks about building a football team.
Robert Mays joining us from the Athletic Football Show with Dane Brugler, who, of course, Mountain Union guy and has been on our show before, and Robert writing for The Athletic as well. If you had to pick the guy with the most upside, who you think this guy has the best chance of being a starting quarterback in the NFL and being at the very least competent, would it be Pickett, who had a rough go with Matt Canada and all that stuff, which I couldn't agree with you more? Dylan Gabriel, who if he starts would be, what, the one of four starting quarterbacks in the league who's under 6 foot tall? Or Shedeur, with all of everything that happened to him in the draft?
On a football level, I'd still say Shedeur. You know, when you watch him, it's not a disaster. Like, there's a reason that the guy was being pumped up as like a top 50 pick in this draft, or somebody that could be taken in the back half of the first round. Like, his physical traits don't wow you. And the thing that worries me the most is when you watch him play, the arm strength isn't fantastic and all that, but it's not what he is as a thrower that concerns me. When he gets into trouble, he does not have the requisite level of athleticism to get himself out of trouble. The amount of times he's quickly chased down, he's trying to either drift out of the pocket or escape the pocket, you just don't really see that with the best quarterbacks in the NFL. Even the guys who aren't overwhelming athletes, like a Brock Purdy, for example, he has enough acceleration and quickness to get himself out of trouble. And so the fact that Shedeur is somebody that doesn't have great pocket presence and also doesn't have the athleticism to mitigate that lack of pocket presence, that's what worries me. But you watch him, he's undeniably accurate. He is really tough in the pocket. There are some pretty darn good throws on tape. And so I do still think, if you're looking at the football characteristics here, he is a better prospect as a quarterback than Dylan Gabriel. And I think that's why he was treated as such over the course of the process. That being said, there is a reason he fell to the fifth round, but I can't really speak to how that personality stuff is going to affect him moving forward. I can only speak to how it affected him in the process with teams.
Are the Browns going to look back and say, why didn't we draft Travis Hunter?
I don't think you can do that.
Okay.
I just think that you have to trust your process in those moments. And I know that's really difficult to do, but this is a team and a franchise that, you know, we're going to look at the Sean Watson contract, and that's what people are going to obsess about. And I completely understand that, right? The amount of money that they're going to have to pay him even moving forward. To me, this element of it that was always more depressing and more detrimental to where the Browns were is the draft picks. You have an entire era of missed draft picks. The Browns had more top 100 picks in this draft than they had in the past two drafts combined. And let's not even talk about top 50 picks. This is a team that needed a reset when it came to building out the young, cost-controlled talent on the team. I mean, you can count the guys that are rookie contract contributors on the Browns from last year. You can do it on one hand. They needed to increase that number. So I know it's going to be tough if Travis Hunter is a great player to watch him succeed in Jacksonville, but I'm just not sure there's any prospect that's not a quarterback that to me is worth three top 40 picks, including a first rounder that could end up in the top 10 that I've never seen play football before, like Travis Hunter.
I don't know how they turned down that trade. You know, I'm with you on that. You can't turn that one down, can you?
I don't think so. Just based on where they are as a franchise, I don't think so. You know, if you're a team, every team is in a different set of circumstances. Every team is at a different place in their build. But for the Browns specifically, I just don't think you can turn it down, especially when your quarterback situation is unsettled. So the Jags, you know, the Jags have talent. The Jags are fun. It's a first-year head coach with a roster that I still don't think is great. So there is a chance. You know, say Trevor, we always do this. Remember when, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it wasn't the Texans, but the Texans had traded away the future firsts, maybe for Tunsil. That's what it was. So the Texans traded those future firsts for Tunsil. And people are looking at the Texans and they're saying, oh, well, they have Deshaun Watson. They'll be fine. And then Watson gets hurt and they're picking in the top five. This stuff happens all the time. The Seahawks did it with the Russell Wilson deal when they traded, or with the Jamal Adams trade, where it's like, well, we're a good team. We'll never be doing this. And then a guy gets hurt and you're picking in the top 10. And so there's a chance next year, based on how things go, that they have two picks in the top 15 in a draft where they need a quarterback. So I just think based on where they are and based on the holes on the roster and the way the last few drafts have gone, it's really, really, really hard to say no to a deal like that.
Robert, last thought. Browns also drafted Quinshon Judkins from Ohio State, then Dylan Sampson, the SEC Offensive Player of the Year, a couple of running backs. Did you like those picks? And it screams to me, here comes the Kevin Stefanski offense back in full force.
I think that's exactly what it says. I think that's exactly what it says. And even looking at, you know, some of the things that they've done in free agency and, you know, the staff and how they've kind of remade that, I think this is we're getting back to basics. We're getting back to meat and potatoes, Kevin Stefanski football, because that is where we are comfortable. And, you know, Jerome Ford is going to be heading into year three, I believe. You know, he's kind of a boomer bust player. I don't think he's going to be in their future plans. So them just deciding to remake their entire running back room in one single offseason, I don't think should be surprising to anybody. And I 100% agree with you that that is the message it sends to me.
Robert, great to have you with us again. We thank you for your time. Robert Mays, The Athletic Football Show. Make sure you listen. Make sure you read him at The Athletic.
Thanks
Robert. Robert joining us on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline.
And right now, Mason Graham is joining us on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Mason, welcome to the show. Welcome to Cleveland.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, we just played the sound, the draft pick being announced. I will never know the feelings that you might have been feeling to have that moment. So just for a kid who is, you know, grown up as a football player and you achieve this moment, what was going through your mind? What was going through your heart as you were getting drafted, and specifically getting drafted with a top five pick?
Yeah, it's really just a dream come true. You know, I was able to, you know, go blessed the opportunity to go to the draft. So, you know, that's a once in a lifetime thing. So I was over there with all my family, friends, close friends, and some of my high school coaches. So it was really just a good time, you know, have my dreams come true. And then, you know, I had a lot of good friends that were also at the draft. So it was cool seeing you know, all respected players, you know, get drafted and have their dreams come true too as well.
Now, Mason, we were just having a conversation about happy crying. Did we get a happy cry out of you when you got drafted?
Not when I got drafted, but probably right after. You know, I went to the back and did some media stuff, but I saw my grandma made like a nice voice message to me, and you know, I got a little emotional there.
I'm gonna get emotional. Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, when grandma's the one that gets the tears rolling, it's like, oh my gosh. Mason, you waited with Will Johnson through day one in his draft slide. I think a lot of people commended how classy that seemed of you. Where did that? It's obviously a teammate. It's someone that you care deeply for. Where did that come from in your mind to be like, I got to be my guy here?
Oh no, I just feel like, you know, that's the type of people, you know, type of person I am, and then, you know, I feel like, you know, if the roles are reversed, Will would be doing the same thing, you know, by my side through, you know, the ups and downs and everything. But, you know, it was just unexpected time for him. You know, a lot of the, you know, frustration on his end, I understand it. You know, didn't feel where he wanted to, but, you know, just supporting him at the end of the day, just like he'd support me, and his family was there too. So it was good to, you know, be there for him. And obviously he didn't get picked in the first day, but, you know, he's blessed to be where he's at, and I know he's going to do great things.
Mason, you strike us here as a bit of a low-key guy. A football guy is always applied to guys who just are about football, are kind of low-key. And so I'm asking this because, I mean, you get the attention for winning the national championship 2 years ago and arguably being the best player on it. You went to one of the awards show and there was some attention because of your date that evening. You know, I'm just curious how a guy who, I mean, you seem like you'd just be happy if you could just go in the film room or just go work out or just hang out with your teammates. What's that been like for a guy who kind of seems a little bit more reserved? How has that been getting used to?
Yeah, I've always been a low-key guy, you know, just been about ball. You know, ever since coming out of high school, I came to Michigan and I wanted to, you know, get to the NFL. That's why I chose Michigan with Coach Harbaugh and everyone there. So I'm really just about getting to highest level and then being at my best. You know, I want to be the best player I can be for, you know, not just myself, but my teammates and, you know, obviously the Cleveland Browns now. So, you know, I want to do whatever it takes to win and, you know, be the best player for the team.
I got to ask you about your wrestling background. Every comp, everything that we read about you, it just kept bringing up that wrestling background. How much of an advantage do you feel like that is in being a multi-sport athlete, but wrestling being the one that goes with you being on the line?
Yeah, I feel like it helped a lot, especially with, you know, interior linemen like O-line and D-line. You know, the battles in a small, compact space, and, you know, there's a lot of the big things I took away from it was, like, leverage. Just feeling different, how body weight moves and how you can, you know, fight pressure with pressure. But I just feel like it's really good for, you know, physical and mental toughness as well.
I don't know if you know this. Myles Garrett is a unit. I mean, that man is stacked. Do you think? I can't remember if Myles wrestled. You think you can take Myles in a wrestling match?
I don't know. You know, people always, you know, talked about me as a state champ wrestler. You know, I wasn't that. I went to the state tournament, but I kind of just, you know, went out there and tried my best, and I didn't really have any technique. I was just all pure aggression and you know, just grit at that point.
This feels like if you wanted to assert your dominance, I'm just saying, like, the NFL, very macho place. If you wanted to assert your dominance, it only works if you win. You could challenge Myles to that and see.
Yeah, day one.
Day one.
Myles, this is my line now.
In mini camps, and just, you know, just see where it goes from there. I'm just thinking outside the box there.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Just excited to work with him, though.
I imagine. I do have to ask you, there's a video circulating about you getting prank called on draft night. Is that a real video? Did you actually get prank called? And what's your reaction to all these players that are getting prank called in their greatest, one of the great moments of their life?
Yeah, that was a real video. I got prank called, but it's kind of weird how it all came along. So the Browns, Andrew Berry and then Coach Stefanski and everyone called me up for my FaceTime video. Off of Cleveland area code, obviously, and then I answered that, had my conversation, told me they were picking me. I was really excited. Then I got another call like a few seconds after I hung up the phone from another Cleveland number, so I thought it was just like someone from the staff reaching out to me with more information on what's next. So I answered the phone, and then there was someone trying to be Coach Stefanski, but I was kind of confused with the whole thing because they prank called me after I got picked. So he was like, this is Coach Stefanski here. We're going to pick you. I was like, I was kind of confused. And then he did. He obviously had his moment of glory or whatever you may call that. But, yeah, I've just been trying to deal with it. You know, there's a lot of people calling me, so I'm going to have to get a new phone here or something.
Mason Graham on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. So take us through the draft process for you. Like, you know, what were kind of some of your goals throughout the draft process? And what teams were you kind of most closely linked to throughout the process?
Yeah, I just wanted to take this process for what it is, you know, meeting a bunch of teams. You know, it might become a long and repetitive process, but I wanted to take it, you know, as serious as I wanted to. And, you know, that was the ultimate level. So I just wanted to be really serious about it. And then, you know, obviously it's an interview. So I kind of, you know, did my best. I put my best foot forward. You know, the tape speaks for itself, but, you know, the teams really wanted to know who I was as a person. So that was pretty cool.
Were you tipped off at all that the Browns had this large of an interest in you?
I knew I was one of the players for consideration, but, you know, once I saw the trade, you know, everything's out of my control, obviously, but, you know, I did what I did on my end. You know, I feel like I had a good visit and, with all the coaches, and seemed like it would be a good fit. So here we are.
Mason, who was your favorite team growing up?
I never had a favorite team growing up.
How is that possible? Did you watch a lot of NFL growing up?
I don't know. Yeah, I watched a lot of football. I just never had, like, a team, really.
That makes this easier.
Mason, I got to ask you about, you know, you say you're slapping Ohio State around not once, not twice, but three straight years, that line, and now you're going to share a locker room with Judkins and a lot of Ohio State players. I'm sure you don't regret any of that, but what went through that moment?
Yeah, no, I don't regret any of it, but it's cool to, you know, join forces with the, you know, the enemy for the past few years. But, you know, it's really cool. Just, you know, I just want to play alongside great players that, you know, just want to win. So Michigan, Ohio State, no matter where you go, you know, I'm going to come in and play with whoever I got.
What's it going to be like to go against Zach Zinter again in practice?
It's going to be really cool. Just, I mean, the battles we had during practice, you know, for my 2 years that I played with him, it was really fun. Iron sharpens iron.
Yeah, iron sharpens iron. There's no doubt about that. Is there anyone that has reached out within the Browns that maybe got you excited to hear from, or anyone that maybe we wouldn't think of?
Not really. I mean, it's been hard to kind of navigate because my phone's been, you know, I don't know who's who. People are pretending to be someone they're not. So I've kind of letting it cool down. But I talked to Miles, or he gave a little message to me on draft night. So that's cool.
What's it going to be like? Now, obviously, you got to kind of go out there, got to stay healthy, got to get out there. What's it going to be like to share a defensive line with a player who's already well on his way to Canton?
Yeah, I mean, it's a honor to be, you know, drafted by a team with a, you know, established vet. You know, I hope to learn a lot from him. He's done a lot of great things, and, you know, he's at the peak of, you know, football. You know, he's, you know, one of the best, if not the best right now. So just want to learn as much as I can from him. And, you know, it's just going to be cool tearing it up alongside him and, you know, all the other guys on the D-line.
As I'm sure you stayed watching the draft, and obviously Shador was a big topic of conversation for the 4 months and what turned out to be your draft. Are you excited to meet Shador? Is there any sort of, did you feel any sadness when you started to see the fifth round and it be Shador and he's still there and then the Browns take him and then you have a bunch of happiness? What was your reaction there?
Yeah, I'm just cool. You know, there's a lot of controversy about us drafting two quarterbacks, but, you know, I love the competition. You know, I want to play. You know, I just want to get the best players, and I think that's what we did. And just play alongside those guys and, you know, get to know them and, you know, make those guys my new teammates and brothers.
I think JP's one question away. He's the ultimate Shador honk in town.
I love Shador.
I think he's one question away from seeing if he can get Shador's number from you.
Yeah, I don't have his number yet.
You debated it for a second. Yeah. I wondered if Shador had texted you, if he'd been part of the group of people that texted you, but I guess not.
No, I don't even know. I need to clear out this phone. This thing's getting blown up.
All right, Mason, obviously we know you're about football. We know, but we just don't, you know, because you're such a low-key guy, as you've said, you know, what are the other things that Mason Graham is about? How do you spend your off time?
Well, I really spend it, you know, around the facility. You know, in college we didn't get too much time off, so, you know, I was always just getting rehab, treatment, lifting, just in the facility or, you know, if not, hanging out with my teammates and then, you know, hop on the game sometimes, play little video games and have some fun time together.
What video game are you playing?
We play Call of Duty.
Okay. All right. Now, I am like six editions of Call of Duty behind because I stopped playing it when it stopped being World War II, which is like my favorite iteration of the game because I'm 150, Mason. So I'll ask you, what's your favorite part of Call of Duty?
I like the zombies. Like when I growing up, I played like a lot of Black Ops. Like when Black Ops 1 was out and then Black Ops 2 and 3, you know, that was my, you know, Black Ops 2 is really the most fun game, in my opinion, that I played growing up with all my friends. We'd be on zombies, get to, you know, be on the microphone together and try to get to the highest level.
You ever go Leroy Jenkins on anyone?
Nah.
I do, all the time. I get bored.
It's the only fun part of the game for me.
I also want to know, if you ever played College Football 2025 after it came out, would you ever play as Ohio State?
I probably wouldn't play as Ohio State, honestly.
All right, that's fair. What about Bowling Green? We're right down the road.
I'd probably play with Bowling Green, maybe.
Okay, I was he's just thinking to himself, why wouldn't I just play with Michigan all the time, you idiot?
Playing at Michigan is a cheat code on those games. I was just thinking.
He'll take the cheat code. That's why he went
stripes,
there.
Earn your stripes at BG.
He went there for that cheat code. Isn't that right, Mason Graham? So I said, yeah. I said cheat. That was the buzzer word there. I'm sorry, Mason.
Mason, we appreciate you, buddy. Welcome to Cleveland. No sign stealing questions for you, buddy. But we do appreciate you. Cannot wait to watch you dominate in brown and orange this year.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
You got it. Thank you, Mason.
Don't think he'd like the Connor Stallions references.
That's okay. That's a nice kid.
Very nice kid. To our conversation with Mason Graham in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Cavs waiting on Sunday. Now they now have the Indiana Pacers to look forward to as we'll get ready for round two of the Eastern Conference playoffs. And to talk about it, we welcome in Brian Geltzeiler, SiriusXM NBA Radio, also NBA TV. He joins us right now on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How we doing?
We're doing well. Are we allowed to overlook the Indiana Pacers, or are they a team that can sneak up on the Cleveland Cavaliers and get them?
No, they can sneak up and get them. You cannot overlook the Indiana Pacers. They're deep. They're versatile. They have enough size. And again, they go to the bench and they got a really good bench. But you saw what Halliburton can do in a big spot, and they look great in that Milwaukee series. I don't know if Milwaukee's the biggest challenge, but I think you can't sleep on the Indiana Pacers. There's a lot of players there. The thing about the Pacers, and you know, they play fast. They like to put up a bunch of threes. But here's the thing about the Indiana Pacers: last half of the season, they were eighth in the NBA in defensive efficiency. They're a really, really good defensive basketball team. A better defensive basketball team than the one that went to the conference finals last year. So there's no sleeping on this Indiana Pacer group at all. As great a year as the Cavs have had, the Pacers went further than they did last year. So for the Cavs here, it's all business right now. This is a tough, tough team that they're up against.
Maybe part of it is, Brian, that you could take a certain parts of the season. As we know, Halliburton was awful at the start of the year, and as he goes, the entire team goes. So it's hard to try to figure out. Like, if you took the Cavs and their shooting numbers the last 2 months of the year, they're dreadful. And their offense actually was like below middle of the pack in those times. So that's why, as a Cavs fan, it's hard, especially the games that we played against Indiana this year. you know, it wasn't the finished Cavaliers product with DeAndre Hunter, and they had injuries in some of those games too. So that's why it's tough to take a snapshot for these two teams to try to compare.
Listen, I think as a general concept, you have to be very careful extrapolating what happens in the regular season over to the playoffs. And there's several reasons for that. But the first two most important ones are, number one, how coaches coach. Because number one, a lot of coaches are going deeper into their bench in the regular season. They're going to play their starters more. Also, coaches aren't showing you all of their best looks in the regular season. They save some stuff for the playoffs. So you're definitely seeing different matchups attacked in different ways, different defensive looks and defensive coverages that you don't normally get in the regular season. Here's the other thing, and this year has been, it's been a big contrast. The physicality of playoff basketball is back in a big way in the NBA. They are letting a lot go. They're letting guys play. They're letting players decide games. And that's different than the regular season. The regular season is a lot about letting offense happen and blowing a lot of whistles. You are not seeing a lot of whistles being blown here in the playoffs. It's quite obviously a league-wide mandate. I'm all for it. I think it's terrific. But it also makes it much tougher to look at a regular season matchup where guys are able to operate in space, get fouls when they go to the basket, and what you have now, which has some prison ball aspects to it, where big teams are just banging the heck out of each other, being really physical. Referees are keeping their whistles in their mouths and not blowing them. So, I think all those things kind of lend itself to, when you look at the regular season, there's only so much to take from it that's going to be applicable to what's going to happen here in a playoff series.
Do you like that there's that style of contrast in what they'll call and what they won't call between the regular season and the postseason?
I don't mind it. I think it's okay for the product to look a little bit different. I really do. I think that, listen, 82 regular season games are a long time. And you're going to get guys beating on each other and pounding on each other in the way they are in the playoffs right now. You're not going to have a lot of guys playing in the playoffs. You're going to have a lot more injuries. And the game itself is not going to be as aesthetically pleasing. But come playoff time, when you have the best teams in the league going up against each other, I think you have to do it this way. Listen, here's the thing about the NBA. The history of the league will tell you that the league's been at its best when playoffs are played this way. There's a huge criticism earlier this year about the homogeneous effect of NBA basketball. All teams look the same and play the same. Are we seeing that complaint right now? Are we seeing any of that right now? Every team looks a little bit different, but the one thing that is a common element here, if you're not big and physical enough, you're struggling in these playoffs. And personally, me, I'm okay with it. I think this is how it should be. I think this has been as good a first round as we've had in a while.
All right, how do you break down the Pacers and what they are trying to do? Because if you look statistically, Haliburton was dreadful shooting the basketball in the playoffs, and he runs hot and cold when in terms of aggression. But when the game was at its biggest moment, he was attacking Giannis and getting past him with relative ease, and also made some key defensive plays in that final game. So what do you make of his game, and how worried should the Cavs fans be about defending him?
It's a great question, because the Haliburton matchup to me is the single most difficult matchup for the Cavaliers in this series. Because I actually think that, Siakam, who's a factor more times than not, and certainly was in that last Milwaukee game, but I think Evan Mobley is going to handle him just fine. So I don't have my concerns there. Haliburton is the single most difficult matchup, and I think they're going to try to match up on Haliburton with some size. I think you'll see Hunter spend some time on him. I think you'll see Strus spend some time on him. And that matchup is going to be difficult. But the thing about Haliburton, what will happen is, for a guy that carries himself with such, confidence is the kind word, arrogance is probably the unkind word, but he carries himself in that way, he'll lose confidence in his game at times if shots aren't necessarily falling. So I think there is an aspect here in how you defend him. First of all, defend him with size, be really, really physical with him, and see if you can get him off his game a little bit. The other thing that I think is going to be different, and even like with him going by Giannis, like one of the things you see in playoff series is, and you're seeing this in the Knicks-Detroit series right now, with the Knicks exclusively guarding Cade Cunningham with OG Anunoby. What happens is a great player will be able to, over the course of a long series, get comfortable with one guy guarding him and be able to figure out where those guys' strengths and weaknesses are. It's one of the advantages of a playoff series. You're playing the same team over and over and over again. I think a big key for the Cavaliers here in Halliburton is going to be to show him different looks, to continuing to roll guys at him in different ways. It's hard for the Cavs because you may give Mitchell him a little bit, but I don't want to give Mitchell him, I don't want to put Mitchell on him a ton, and you can't put Garland on him. And so I think that's where things get tough also. The Cavs have two viable defenders to guard him, in my estimation. You could maybe say Okoro's a third one, but I don't know how many minutes Okoro's going to get here. But you have two viable guys to guard him, and Hunter and Strus, and maybe mix Mitchell in as a third. I'd rather they have three really viable guys, because that's what Halliburton can do, but it's going to be two. And we'll see kind of where that goes, but I think that's the key matchup here. And with all that said, I do think personnel-wise, the Cavs are equipped to handle him.
Brian Geltzeiler joining us, NBA TV, SiriusXM NBA Radio. Did you get a chance to see much of Ty Jerome in the last two games of the Heat series against the Cavs?
I did. I mean, listen, Ty Jerome is one of these guys that, like, when he heats it up and gets it going, he's tough. He's really, really tough to stop. First of all, the thing about a guy like Ty Jerome, like, you hear the term all the time, a floor spacer. But what he does in spacing the floor and creating the ability for Mitchell to break a guy down off the dribble and Garland to break a guy down off the dribble, it is absolutely vital for this basketball team. So when you get Jerome going, he actually takes this offense to an entirely different level. One of the great stories in the NBA this year. And listen, he can really, really handle himself. Here defensively, you wonder where you're going to hide him. I kind of figure you can put him on Nembhard and take your chances there, as strong a player as Nembhard is, because again, I just think Jerome can match him. Even if Nembhard's scoring on him, Jerome can score on the other end. So we'll obviously see plenty of Ty Jerome minutes, but guys, this is again one of the best stories in the NBA. The dude has been absolutely phenomenal. He's shooting lights out right now, and really, you know, if he can keep this going, the Cavs are a tough, tough out.
Yeah, because we've had some silly discussions recently because Darius has not really had anything in terms of a playoff career. He's kind of struggled. He certainly struggled against longer teams. And Jerome is now in the playoffs and showing people what he could do, but he's doing it in limited minutes. And we've got players from the Miami Heat talking trash about Darius Garland. Listen to this clip from Kyle Anderson yesterday in their locker cleanup day.
If you want my honest answer, and I don't mean to throw shots at anybody or even, you know, entertain what was going on between them, but I think they look like a better team without Garland on the floor. Now, I don't know the numbers or anything, but I think it played more into their favor once Garland wasn't on the floor for them. They were able to dictate the tempo and, you know, get more stops on defense, and it was hard for us to score, and, you know, they had more guys out there on defense. So I think once we came across that, it got kind of tough for us.
So that kind of punctuates a little bit of a conversation. It's a fringe conversation in Cleveland over Garland versus Jerome. What do you make of that?
I think that Kyle Anderson should worry about the 37-win team that just got swept out of the playoffs that he was on, okay, with a record point differential in terms of a margin of victory. That's what, like, you watch the Cavs all season. They're a better team with Darius Garland. And Ty Jerome's a very, very good player. It's what's the special part of the Cavs this year, guys, besides for the jump Mobley made, was the chemistry that developed between Mitchell and Garland on the floor on the offensive end. And yeah, they made is there something to be said in terms of maybe being a little bit better defensively with Jerome? But it doesn't really matter. Whoever it is, whether it's Garland or Jerome, you're going to try to hide him on Nembhard. And again, if Nembhard's going to be the one that beats you, but you're doing a good job on Halliburton and Siakam, you're going to win the series. Like, and that's just kind of silly stuff because, and this is why it's also silly stuff. Because when you get, let's assume the Cavs get through the series just for the moment. This series is not going to be easy, but let's assume they get through this series and you go into a conference final against the Celtics. You're going to need that kind of dynamic shot making in the backcourt from somebody besides Donovan Mitchell. And for as good as Jerome is, Darius Garland's a better player off the dribble offensively. Can do so much more. Like, he's just a more dynamic offensive threat. I don't think there's any two ways about it. All due respect to Ty Jerome, who's had a super year. But again, it's more of a catch and shoot thing. And not that he can't play off the dribble. He's a pretty good player off the dribble. Garland's a better player off the dribble. And so I hear that from Kyle Anderson, and it strikes me as like, you know what, dude, if you're not sitting in the ESPN studio table, you're still playing in a league. It's kind of a silly piece of analysis to look at what you guys did when you could say about how you struggled, you weren't going to be close no matter who played. And I think that's the point with Kyle Anderson that we kind of have to look at here. Those are comments, obviously, guys, coming from a 37 player on a 37-win team that didn't play all that much, that just got swept. I kind of think that's the dictionary definition of speaking out of school.
Ooh. Wow. Ooh, wow. Ooh. Brian Geltzeiler, this is coming in hot.
All right. Turn up the heat.
Pascal Siakam, such an interesting matchup. He has 75 playoff games. He's got more experience than just about anybody on the Cavs in terms of the playoffs. And he's had some big moments on big teams. He's also had a bunch of moments where he has been very challenged trying to score efficiently. What do you make of that matchup with him, and how much do you think he'll be matched up with Evan Mobley?
A lot. And I think that matchup, here's the thing. I'm making an assumption in that matchup in this series that the Cavs are going to win that matchup. Evan Mobley was voted Defensive Player of the Year. Because if the Cavs don't win that matchup, Evan Mobley shouldn't have been voted Defensive Player of the Year. You can take Siakam out of his game. Evan Mobley's more athletic than he is. He's a little bit bigger. He can certainly stay with him both inside and outside. If Siakam's putting up 28, 26, and 30, that's a problem for Cleveland in this series because other guys are going to get points. I just got done telling you that the Hyder guy is going to be on Nembhard, and Nembhard's going to have a good series because of that. Whether it's Garland or Jerome, the Hyder defender, the one they're trying to hide, is going to be on Nembhard, which means that you're going to have to do a really good job on Siakam. You're going to have to do a really good job on Halliburton. You're going to have to make sure that Turner doesn't kill you too much. Like this, and even a guy like Nesmith, you got to make sure you match up properly. And he had 19, you know, in this last game. He's a tough player. So my point being on the Siakam-Mobley matchup, if that doesn't work to the Cavs' favor, this series is a difficult, really going to be really, really difficult for the Cavs, and they may not win it. And that's how vital that matchup is. But to me here, listen, Evan Mobley was on most improved player ballots. He was defensive player of the year. We're going to get all defense teams coming out in the next week or so. He's going to be on the first team for that. Evan Mobley's been given all these defensive accolades. This is the time where you show who you are. And if Mobley doesn't do that in this series, he probably shouldn't have gotten any award, and the Cavs are going to have a problem.
Brian Geltzeiler laying it down right now. He's on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline. Go ahead. I got other NBA things I want to ask
about. So LeBron.
I wanted to ask about LeBron.
I'll do this instead. Eastern Conference, it looked to me like Boston never Orlando was a real threat in that series. However, it was a little harder for the Celtics than I thought it would be. Do you make anything of that?
Not really. You know, listen, they rested Drew Holiday. They rested. He was hurt, but he probably could have gone in two of those games, and they chose to not put him out there when they were up in the series with the thought that they just, if they could close this thing out and get him extended rest, they'd be better. Listen, Orlando's a really good defensive basketball team. But collectively, taking Paolo Banchero out of the mix, the rest of those guys in that team, you have them throw a bag of garbage off a pier and they can't hit the water. These guys cannot shoot the basketball. So, yes, it was a little bit of a grinded out series because Orlando plays physically tough in that way. That's part of their identity, but they're not a good offensive team. And so I think when you look at Boston there, I don't think it was a big deal. They didn't have Holiday the whole series, right? And Tatum sat a game that you won that he was hurt with a bad wrist. I look at that for Boston getting out in five. I think that's a win for them. Plenty of rest here. Listen, everybody needs the rest there. The more rest Porzingis gets, the better. The more rest Holiday gets, the better. The more rest Tatum's wrist gets. And Tatum was super when he came back. But more rest Tatum's wrist gets, the better. So I actually think, yes, it was going to be physical against Orlando no matter what. That's what they bring and who they are. With all that said, I actually like what I saw out of the Celtics in that series. They did a good job of taking care of business, considering they weren't fully healthy for a large portion of the series.
Brian Geltzeiler joining us on the show. So do these last years, I mean, the bounce in the first round last night to the Minnesota Timberwolves, do these last years with the Lakers mean anything to LeBron's legacy?
Yeah, I think they actually enhance his legacy. You just like, and it's a very funny example, watching a game the other night, and they put some kind of record on the screen, you know, first guy to put up this, this, and this over the age of 40. And my wife looked at me and goes, isn't this kind of a silly graphic? Who else was ever doing this at 40? Like, and I think that's where we look at the legacy. We like to be about, you know, rings, right? How many rings? LeBron James I voted him as a second team All-NBA guy. The dude is 40. No one does this at 40. So I'll say this. He's enhancing his legacy with playing at an all-NBA level into his 40th birthday. That the longevity part now becomes a huge part of that. None of the other all-time greats we discuss have that longevity part. And no, I'm not going to do this LeBron Jordan thing. I'm a Michael Jordan guy, always will be. And that's not where I'm going. But I am saying, to think that a first-round exit for the Lakers does any damage to LeBron James, I just don't find that valid. I don't think that's an opinion I would ever agree with. I think that his legacy has been enhanced by what he does. I will say this, a bigger picture regarding the Lakers. If I'm LeBron James, I'm having a one-on-one sit-down with Luka Doncic this week, like now, before everybody breaks apart, and I'm going to look him in the eye, and I'm going to tell him, you get one more year with me, but if you don't show up, forget about the best shape of your career. I'm talking about the best shape of any NBA player ever, because I'm going to be in that shape if I'm LeBron. I'm showing up in peak condition. You need to be in the shape I'm in, and if you're in the shape I'm in, and we go do this, I'll hang around for a few more years with you. If you're going to show up in this kind of condition, and like you were when you got traded here, and like you've been this entire season, I'm done after this year. LeBron doesn't have a lot of years left, okay? There's some urgency for Luka Doncic to get himself in the proper condition and be able to realize his vast potential. And that was a problem for the Lakers in this series, specifically defensively. Luka was tired. He was out of shape. He was banged up because he was out of shape. And defensively in these last two games, the Timberwolves made him look stupid. They took gross advantage of him. So if I'm LeBron James, I have to tell you, that is my big mandate here with Luka. You get yourself in shape, or I don't know how much longer I'm doing this with you.
Brian, you're outstanding. Thank you so much for the time. And I say this to a lot of people. I really hope it with you. I hope we run you down again soon. Thank you.
Guys, my pleasure. Anytime. We'll talk to you both soon. Take care.
Find him on Twitter, at BGeltsNBA on Twitter. He's one of the best. Strong stuff. The stuff he said about Kyle Anderson. Holy potatoes.
On the line, Odyssey Sports NBA insider, Danny Green. Rookie when LeBron was with the Cavaliers. Insider calls brought to you by Hyundai. We put your safety first and everything else second. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com. Danny, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Danny.
Thanks, man. What's up, fellas? How you guys doing?
We're going to talk Cavs in a second here. You were a rookie when LeBron was on the Cavaliers. You saw it up close and personal. He's 40 years old. They get knocked out in five by Minnesota. That team's not good, but, man, they got Luka and they got LeBron. And LeBron said, can't tell you if I'm coming back or not. He's still playing great basketball. Does he have more basketball in him? Yeah, does he have more basketball in him?
He for sure has more basketball in him. And I think we all know that he's coming back. There's no way he leaves without at least getting, you know, a farewell tour, you know, and the people appreciating it. And then, you know, Bronny's getting a chance to play with him another year with Bronny. I'm sure he'd probably get Bryce there if he could. But he definitely has more basketball in him. He's playing great at high level. He just needs help, and you know, everybody's been saying it. You know, at 40 years old, he can't be the best player on your team or the second best player on your team to win a championship. But he's playing. He said he's got enough. He said to, you know, the 5 years. I don't know about that, but he proves me wrong and everybody else wrong every year. But he's definitely got a couple more years left of good basketball in him.
All right, Danny, I'm going to ask you this question just because we're kicking it around. I know what we think. I want you to be honest now on this one because I think sometimes great players have trouble.
Danny lies? Is that what you're saying?
No.
You want him to be honest now?
He'll be honest on
this. Danny never lies.
Yeah, and we all know that LeBron probably wants to own a team someday. Would LeBron be a good head coach in the NBA when he's done doing this?
I don't know, man. I have a theory about star players trying to coach or be GMs. I don't know if they're that great, they could be good at it. I think he could. He has IQ for it. And he definitely knows personnel well. He knows how to, you know, I guess, orchestrate a locker room. So, yeah, I don't see why not. I don't know. Great head coach, though. I don't know. I don't know if he'll have the patience. It'll be hard for him to, because his standard for expectation for like what he's done for himself is hard to keep that for other normal players, you know? So, I think he could be a good head coach. Great. I don't know. I mean, I think that'd be tough. I think it's very tough for a lot of the like superstars to be able to coach role players.
Danny, I wonder this. They have LeBron. They have Luka. And after that, what do the Lakers have that can put LeBron and Luka where they want to be next year? And do they, and I like Austin Reeves, you know, Rui Hachimura can be a good player, but do they have the players, the assets to put a championship caliber team around those guys? Because if not, man, I would think that LeBron, I don't know that he would look for a trade, ask for a trade. I mean, L.A. works on so many levels for him. But, man, I wonder about him sitting there on a team that he thinks might not be able to compete for an NBA championship.
I mean, that's the question, right? What they have a good piece. They said Rui's great. Austin's good. They have really good pieces. They need more depth. And do they have the assets to get it? I don't know if they do. I don't know if they have enough space or cap space. LeBron could opt out and take a cut if he wanted to get more talent around him. But they do have a good foundation. They do need more depth. They do need a big. But, yeah, and that's the tricky part, right, being a front office. The good thing I'm not a GM or have Rob Pelinka's job. It's not an easy one. But, yeah, I think with the because they were a three seed in the West. The West is no, you know, slouch. It's a really tough conference. But let me get a three seed. They show that they have talent. They just need some depth. They ran out of fatigue. You know, Bron's 40. And he was one of the best players on the floor most nights.
Yeah.
So you need to find some other guys and some guys you can play. You can't have games where you play them the whole second half, you know, and Bron has to play 40-plus minutes. The priority for them is to get a big. I'm sure people talk about Luka getting in shape and be able to play defense a little bit better, which I don't think it changes defensive habits or his style of play. But they could surround him with better defensive pieces to make them all look better and for LeBron to get some rest. Another thing that I think will be hard for Bron in the coaching aspect is dealing with egos. You know, that's the other part of, you know, GM, finding the right guys that fit with the system, that fit with JJ, that fit with Luka and Bron. So that's why it's hard for star players to also coach, because it's going to be hard to deal with other players. And in today's NBA, with the sensitivity and the egos, it's not an easy thing to maneuver.
Mm. Danny, how good is this Indiana-Cavs matchup going to be in the playoffs?
I think it's going to be great, man. It's going to be a lot of high power, fast pace. You know, Indiana likes to get up and down. And then both teams are getting, you know, physical, chippy. It's obviously going to be a lot better. I'm going to say obviously, but I'm assuming it's going to be better than the Miami matchup. Miami played better in Cleveland than they did at home, and it got bad for them. But I'm looking forward to this matchup. I still think Cleveland is the better team. They have more depth, and they should get it done in six. But Indiana, man, they're showing some toughness and some grit, and they've been fighting. So it's going to be a hell of a matchup.
Danny Green joining us, and Insider Calls are brought to us by Hyundai. Hyundai helps protect you and your family out on the road. We put your safety first and everything else second. The thing that I love looking at in a series, Danny, who matches up with who? How does this work? Which team might have an advantage? Cavs have a terrific backcourt, though it's on the smaller side. They have a big front court, which is terrific. The wing guys, okay, whatever. You can figure that out. They do have guys. I like DeAndre Hunter. Max Strus can get hot. There are guys that can certainly do some things out there. And you have Ty Jerome in the backcourt as well. But Indiana has four guys who start who are all kind of long for wing guys and guards, 6'4 to about 6'8, and only Miles Turner inside. Which team can exploit the other team's main starting five and the main guys who are going to play more in this series? What do you think?
I mean, that's the coaching part of it, right? It's a chess game and see what Kenny can bring to the table that JB didn't. And then on the other side, Rick Carlisle, vice versa, see what he can do. It's going to be a big series for Tyrese Haliburton matched against Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, and then Ty Jerome, like all the wings that you guys have. And they throw multiple bodies at him, like DeAndre Hunter, Max Strus. There's so many guys that can guard him, even Isaac Okoro. And you got Green on the bench as well, Javante. So you guys have the advantage pretty much all right, because it's going to be a hell of a series for Pascal, too, matchup with Evan Mobley, defensive player here. It's going to be a huge series for Miles Turner and Tyrese Haliburton. Miles Turner has to figure out a way to give Pascal some relief and make it easier for him, and Tyrese Haliburton is going to have to try to control the tempo because they both have an uphill battle with the depth that Cleveland has. So I think you guys have the advantage damn near all around. Mm-hmm. But I could see Rick Carlisle trying to exploit and trying to get the mismatches and get screens for Pascal and Tyrese and trying to put Darius in action, even making Donovan guard, you know, because they want to wear him down. And any smart team, one of the big star player, their main scorer, to play defense, you know. But the smaller guards, I feel like they're going to try to attack those smaller guards if they can. But ultimately, I just don't think they have enough. But it's going to take for Tyrese Haliburton and Miles Turner to really step up and play, you know, out of body. And then, of course, off the bench, TJ McConnell, Obi Toppin, those guys have to play well, Mathurin too. But like I said, those two guys are the key. They have to really step up for them to have a chance.
Danny, you mentioned a matchup that I think could be intriguing, but I'm not sure how it's going to go and how it's going to play out. and that is Pascal Siakam when Evan Mobley guards him. Is it an advantage for Indy if Pascal can drag Evan out on the floor, or is Evan going to have a huge advantage if Pascal has to try to defend him?
I think there's advantage and disadvantage on both sides. Okay. I think Pascal has the advantage on the outside, like you just mentioned, because he can shoot a perimeter. He's a little faster. He's more of a guard-like player. And Evan's got the size advantage inside. You know, he can shoot over Pascal. He can, you know, back him down or post him up, shoot a jump hook, left hook. Pascal's not going to be able to block that. His best bet is try to be physical with him and push him out. But Evan's really worked on his game and his body. And he's not thin, flimsy kid anymore. So it's going to be interesting to see who imposes their will. And that's where the mental aspect of the game comes in. You know, I've seen some of the greats play great. I've seen some of the average guys play really well. And I've seen some of those great guys not play so well because of the mental part side of it. And when I say these things, you know, certain people come to mind. Like, oh, this guy was a great player, but in the playoffs, he didn't play so well. This guy was not so good in the regular season, but in the playoffs, he became unbelievable. You know, some guys just arise to the occasion, and it's more of a mental aspect type of deal. So that's pretty much what, you know, the playoffs is, and that's what makes it interesting and fun to watch, to see, you know, who has the mental fortitude, who's going to step up, who has the mental toughness, you know, to be one of those guys.
Yeah, Danny, you know, you talk about the mental part of this, and I keep thinking about if you're a young player in the playoffs, and I mean, the Miami series is what the Miami series was. As you try to advance, obviously everything gets turned up, everything gets tighter. What's the most important thing a young player to the playoffs at this point in their career needs to know? You put your toe in the water against Miami, or maybe you've had a couple games through there, but I mean, now you're in the pool, right? And
yeah.
And so what's the most important thing for a younger player to know that an older player can make sure they accomplish while they're doing this?
I mean, there's so many things, but I think it's the most important thing is like possession by possession. I mean, every possession is important, and you have to be locked in for 48 minutes every game. You can't, you know, take any lapses or take any, you know, plays off, because every basket matters, every loose ball, all those things matter. So, you know, stay even keel, embrace and live in the moment. You know, have fun with it, and don't let the lights and anything get to that. If you just focus on playing and having fun, the lights won't get too bright. You won't worry too much, and the pressure won't. It won't be any pressure. It's just have these are things that you dreamed of as a kid. You know, of being in this moment. So embrace the moment and have fun with it.
And I want your take on this too, because I thought it was interesting. Because I normally am like, man, when you're stepping on the gas in a game and you're really crushing a team, is there a point where you should back off? And I just remember Kenny Atkinson late in the third in that game four against Miami wanted to review a play. And I was like, and during the regular season, I'd be like, really? You're up like 60 and you're reviewing a play? And then
not
somewhere, in the back
absolutely
of my mind,
not.
It's a weird conundrum though sometimes. But
I mean, you've seen what happened with the game last night in Houston and Golden State. At any moment, a team, you don't give them no life, no type of like encouragement. They don't need any positives coming from a game. All it takes is one shot for a shooter to strike iron, one possession for a team to gain confidence, and that could change the whole series around. It may not be for that game. It could be for the next game. But you want to make sure when you have a team down, you keep them down and let them know that, you know, they can't get nothing. They're nothing easy.
I did think it was interesting at the end of the game they did do the gentleman's rule, though, where they didn't shoot and then they didn't shoot. But, I mean, they were up 50.
Yeah,
you know, 50, but, you
sportsmanlike.
Know. Yeah.
Sportsmanlike.
Knicks-Celtics, if it ends up being Knicks-Celtics, what do you think? Does New York have a shot at knocking off the defending champs?
No, I don't think so. Celtics are just such a juggernaut in the East. So is Cleveland. The only thing that so they have a chance with is they're not healthy. But I mean, Orlando gave him some troubles a little bit here and there. But so that's the thing. The Celtics are too talented. They're the best team in basketball when healthy. And the Knicks, they just haven't shown enough to me that impressed me to be like they're struggling with Detroit right now. And it honestly could be 3-2 Detroit if the referees called the right call. So they would be in trouble, but I just don't see them getting the Celtics.
Danny, last thought. You're the Cavs. How do you try to attack Indy? How do you think you win this series? If you're Indy, how do you attack the Cavs?
I mean, so I told you, best bet for any team is to try to, you know, take away a three, the perimeter for them, and try to get the mismatches you can. Try to get those guys in foul trouble. Try to attack the smalls, and that's, you know, Donovan and Darius. And also the bench. I mean, the bench is deep. The bench has – a lot of depth offensively, but defensively. So your best bet is to try to get mismatches and get them in foul trouble.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Pleasure's all mine, man. See you guys next week.
Danny Green going to talk to us all throughout the playoffs, and we can't wait for that. Danny, Insider Calls brought to us by Hyundai. We put your safety first and everything else second, and you can learn more at HyundaiUSA.com. Danny, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, guys.
Danny Green, you know, former Danny. Cavalier NBA champion.
To talk all about your Cleveland Guardians, we have one of our favorite guests here to talk some Guardians baseball. Of Guardians TV, Guardians host Al Pawlowski joining us now on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Al, welcome to the show.
Hey, Nick, Jonathan, great to be here.
So we talked earlier that, you know, we have a couple guys at the station, Al, that went through the 3-hour wait last night and watched the big hit by Manzardo. We heard Stephen Vogt talk about like, we're here. It's just part of the thing. Nobody really cared. How do you folks in the TV side of things handle the rain delays and just trying to keep yourself ready for if baseball time happens?
Well, we go visit with a lot of people in the press box that we've always seen but never talked to, and figured now is a good time to get to know some of these people that are up here. So that's kind of what we were doing yesterday. So I met some new friends. But otherwise, yeah, you're pretty much just sitting there. You know, you're looking at the radar. You're going, okay, we should be able to get this started here at some point tonight. But that's pretty much what we do. But it was good to meet some new friends.
That's good. After obviously the rain delay and everything else, that and really just a bad couple days for the Guardians, they got in the win column. Manzardo with the big home run. He's turning into Kyle Schwarber. It's an interesting development. Just a lot of home runs, not much with batting average or anything else, but that really doesn't matter because this team needed the long ball, Al.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comp. I never thought about that, but I like it. From a power perspective and a key hit perspective, that's a good guy to emulate. Now, if he can, you know, also, he doesn't have a bad eye now, Kyle, but he doesn't have Kyle Schwarber's. I mean, Schwarber and Kwan are about in the same level as far as, you know, understanding the strike zone. But I like it a lot, and I like it because the one thing that, as you alluded to, Kyle Manzardo has shown us here in the early part of the season, number one, the power is definitely developing. Number two, the thing that we love about him is that he's hitting it in key times. Last night in the ninth inning in a tie game, he hit a home run. Obviously, that's going to be a game winner for you. So I like the Schwarber comp. The other guy that I was thinking of as far as a key hit type of guy that did it when he was young in his career and throughout his career for Cleveland is Jason Kipnis. That's another guy that, see, whenever the chips were down and he was at the plate, he always came through for you.
Al, Angel Martinez has been batting at the bottom of the lineup here for the last little bit here. And listen, I understand there's always a lot of strategy here, but I'm looking at kid hitting 333. Is this about they're still just trying to find ways and hide him in the lineup to get him at bats, or is there maybe a strategic reason on why he's the ninth hitter trying to boost some stock there at the bottom of the lineup?
So that's a great question. If you'll talk to veteran managers about this, generally what they'll say now is, you know, when a new kid comes up and they're planning on playing him quite a bit, whether it's somebody like a Kyle Manzardo, because we saw him hit toward the bottom of the order when he first came up last year, or somebody like Angel Martinez, who also has some speed. So one theory could be, all right, we're going to bat him ninth because he's your secondary leadoff hitter. He's just going to get one less at bat than everybody else by hitting in that bottom hole. But the other thing is, too, is to take the pressure off a young hitter. Generally, when you're hitting more toward the bottom of the order, there's going to be less pressure on you. Where if you're up toward the top of the order, you're expected to deliver, either get the big hit like Manzardo did last night, or get on base in front of those guys like Stephen Kwan has such an aptitude to do. That being said, if Angel Martinez continues to hit like he is, get on base like he does, he's got great speed as we've seen it, I don't think it'll be too long before you see him hitting in that two hole. I think that he's destined for that. That he seems to me to be like right now when I look at this group, the perfect two hole hitter. There's other guys that can do it too, but I think that's his ultimate destiny as far as I can see at this moment in time.
Al, Nolan Jones not off to a great start. He didn't play in yesterday's game, but I'm so encouraged, and I feel like I'm crazy saying it, but he just hits the ball so incredibly hard, and his hard hit rate is at, you know, 95 percentile in all of baseball. It just feels like there's better games to come when you're hitting the ball that hard and just consistently not getting rewarded.
Yeah, agreed. That's a big thing now. This, you know, exit velo, is it everything? No, it's not. Luis Arraez will tell you it's not everything. He hits the second to least hardest ball in baseball among qualified hitters, and Luis Arraez is probably your most dangerous hitter for average when he's healthy right now. Stephen Kwan's another guy that would be up there too, but Stephen does hit it a lot harder. That being said, most guys that hit the ball hard give themselves a better chance of getting a hit. It's harder to field. It gets to the gaps quicker. It gets to the holes quicker. You're going to just pick up more base hits. It's obviously going to go further as well when you hit it with that high velo. Last two or three weeks, I think we've seen Nolan Jones put together some pretty good at-bats. We've seen him hit the ball pretty hard. We just had something on our show last night about that, about his top five velos. He's got five velos already, exit velos that are 107 or even better. That's pretty impressive. So I agree. I think it's going to come around. You know, there's always the anomaly guy that it literally tears the cover off the ball, but for whatever reason, he just can't hit for average. But I think that Nolan's going to do it. He showed you 2 years ago when he was in Colorado that he can do it. It is there. It's not like he's over the hill by any stretch. He's still a young guy. I think that he's going to come through eventually.
Al, we got clearly the best start of the season from Tanner Bibee last night. Only gave up five base runners. Did give up one earned, but in seven innings. I mean, that's as good as we've gotten from him. Just 92 pitches as well. And yet, he was on a Jeff Passan article on one of the five players in baseball whose slow starts worry him. So is last night a red herring, or do we think or is Tanner Bibee trending in the right direction?
Yeah, definitely trending in the right direction. I've been around a lot of guys over the years. Tanner Bibee is one that I would worry about the least. He puts in the effort. He's highly competitive. He's healthy. He's the type of guy that you want on your team. You want him to be your number one. You want him to be your ace. He's got the physical characteristics. He's got the right character. He's got the drive. I know he just signed a long-term contract. He's not a guy that just wanted to sign a long-term contract and Anthony Rendon it and decide that, you know what, I really don't care about baseball. That's not Tanner Bibee. So I think what you saw last night, you're going to see more of. He made a slight adjustment and clearly it paid off. I mean, this guy, he's always thinking, he's always working. His dad's a high school coach. He works with him all the time. He's a guy that, he's got everything that you want in an ace pitcher.
Class A got into the game in the ninth. It was a tie game, so not a save situation. Ended up getting the win. How do you see that moving forward with Class A? Is he's kind of been removed from that role, but then the skipper, Stephen Vogt, hasn't really taken that away from him quite yet publicly.
Right, yeah, and he even said last night that Class A is the closer, and I think that, you know, with the amount of money he's getting and the track record that he has shown, I mean, there were some people saying, I agree with this, he was the best pitcher in the world the last couple of years. When you think about it, not a starter, but a guy that came in and just so difficult to hit. Hitters have made an adjustment to him. So it's not hard to see. You can notice it too. They're jumping him. They're looking at the first fastball that's over the plate. They're swinging. They're not letting Class A get ahead of them. So now Class A's got to make an adjustment back. It appears he has from these last couple of outings. What I think also is going to happen, and this is just my opinion, this is not something I heard from anybody, but it's tough when you've got to go 3 days in a row, occasionally four. It's tough, and that takes a lot out of you. Cade Smith is showing you that he can close games too. So now maybe if Class A closes back-to-back games, that third time it's like, okay, Cade Smith's available. Let's use him to close. Let's get Class A a day off. I think that can benefit him. I think it benefits a lot of relief pitchers. Good news is Class A wants the ball, as do most of the good ones. Most of the time, if you want him to go 5 days in a row, he wants that ball. But health-wise and effectiveness-wise, sometimes it's better to get an extra off day in there, and I think that might be what you see. But he is definitely the closer.
Al Pulaski in the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. So we've seen fits and starts from the offense. We've seen fits and starts from the rotation. We've seen fits and starts from the bullpen. Which one of those three is closest to putting it together and maybe finding some significant consistency?
I think it's the bullpen. That's where you got the most depth. That's who's been the most dominating of any aspect of the three that you've mentioned for Cleveland this year. Occasionally you get a bad outing out of the collective bullpen, but generally they're pretty good. I'm not really worried about them at all. I think the starters, You know, I think what you saw from Gavin Williams was an anomaly the other night. I think what you saw from Tanner Bibee last night was more of what you're going to see from him. Ben Lively has really found a home here in Cleveland, and he's figured it out. He's a nice piece. I think you've got some really exciting young guys, too, so I think the rotation is going to be okay. Now, as far as the lineup goes, that is the one area. You know, if we're going to be objective about this, there has been inconsistency. As much as we love the power with Kyle Manzardo, you like to see him hit for a little bit better average. I know that power means more than average right now in Major League Baseball, but you'd like to see a little more of that from him. And then the lower part of the order, there's been a lot of inconsistency, and that's something that you got to get more consistency from the offense, especially from, you know, the guys that are hitting 6 through 9.
Guardians continue their series today against the Twins. And so I got to ask you, you know, Minnesota didn't make many moves this offseason, and they continue to run out, you know, the trio of players that they just rely on. And a lot of them, they can't, remain healthy. Buxton, Correa, those guys. But it's been a lackluster start to the season for them. What do you make of what the Twins' strategy is right now, as they seem like they just continue to just tread water?
What I see from Minnesota, and that's a great question, too, their offense is very good. The last few games, Tanner really cooled them off last night. That was one of the concerning things, too. It's like we're catching Minnesota when they're hot. Pitching-wise, I think that's where Minnesota's going to have some struggles there. You know, I like Joe Ryan a lot. We miss him on this series. Not upset about that in a four-game set. Ober is always good against Cleveland. That's another guy that really has the change of figured out in the off-speed stuff. But after that, I mean, you know, Paddock's not very good. We'll see what they have in Woods Richardson. He's showing flashes and that. But as far as Minnesota goes, I mean, that offense has got a lot of nice young bats. I'm really interested to see how they're going to develop.
Al, great stuff as always, buddy. It's just great to catch up with you. Loving what the Guardians are doing here, staying above water, continuing to figure it out, and can't wait to see what we do the rest of this series and beyond.
Yeah, sounds great, guys. Great talking with you and looking forward to the next time.
Al Pawlowski there on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. So we'll react to what Al had to say, and we do have a little update on the Cavaliers to pass along as well in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.